Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Yosef Lindell, and we are going to be talking about the development of the Pesach Haggadah. Nothing overly ambitious for just 30 minutes, right? Yosef Lindell is a lawyer, writer, lecturer, and an editor at the Lehrer House. He holds a BA in history and an MA in Jewish history from Yeshiva University and a JD from NYU Law. His writing spans several genres from science fiction to scholarship, and he's published more than 30 articles on Jewish history and thought. In addition to his articles at the Lehrer House, he's been published by The Atlantic, The Jewish Review of Books, 1840, JTA, The Forward, Jewish Action, and other venues. Yosef lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, with his wife and two sons, and it's a real privilege to have you on. Yosef, you know, you and I, we've emailed a lot in our correspondences for the Lehrer House, and in fact, I should say, we have a real expert in liturgy who is the right man for this discussion. I think when I wrote some of my Tircha de Tzibura essays for the Lehrer House, I believe you were the editor for them. And you certainly had a supervisory role over many of my pieces. So it's an honor to have you with us here today. And also, I have to be Makar Tov that I think this is the first tshuva of a gon that we are going to be looking at. I've been trying to push our guests away from 20th century, and I've been trying to move to Rishonim, and you are one-upping. We are looking at the Gaonim now. So we're looking at Rav Notranai Gon, cited in the Siddur Derev Amram, and we're going to be talking about the development of the Haggadah, and in particular, the clash and debates that were taking place with the Karaim, with the Karaites at the time. I'm really excited to hear about this. Maybe you want to open up just telling us what is this tshuva that we're looking at and the historical context before we jump into the details.
Yeah, so Moshe, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's really a joy to be here. Indeed, we've worked together quite a bit at Lehrer House on some really interesting and exciting articles that you wrote, and it's always been a pleasure to work with you there. And it's really nice to be speaking with you, and not exactly in person, but virtually at this time. So yeah, so we've got here a tshuva of Rav Notranai Gon. And Rav Notranai Gon was one of the Gaonim in Sura, which was one of the two main yeshivas in Bavel at the time. We have Sura and Pumbedisa. They're both in the vicinity of Baghdad and under, you know, the Islamic rule. At the time, so we're talking like the middle of the ninth century. He was the predecessor of Rav Amram Gon. And Rav Amram Gon indeed wrote the Siddur of Amram Gon. And this is really the Siddur that we use today. This is really the first complete copy of the Siddur that we have. And what's very interesting is that the Siddur itself is a tshuva, because the Gaonim generally wrote tshuvas. We do not have a lot of independent works that the Gaonim wrote before Rav Sadia Gaon, really. Rav Sadia Gaon is really the first to start writing, you know, Emunos Videos and dictionary and his Tafsir, his translation of the Torah. There are many independent books that Rav Sadia Gaon wrote. Before that, you really don't have a lot of independent books. You'll say, well, we have some. We have like the Halachos Gedolos of Bahag. We have the She'otos of Rav Achai Gaon, although my limited understanding is that scholars are somewhat divided on to what extent those can be called books by a single author in the same way. And they may have actually been collections that developed more over time.
So it's like the same theories of biblical authorship that takes place in academia have been applied, unsurprisingly, to these later works as well.
I mean, again, this is not like something I'm like a huge expert on, the development of the book per se, and author culture among Jewish thought. But it is interesting to think about the fact that we do have a pretty big transition, that we're talking about, if we're talking about Bavel, we're talking about the Amoraim who are writing the Gemara, and the whole thing is transmitted orally. And you really don't have a lot of writing down in general until you get to the Gaonim, like in the year like 700 or so, and suddenly we start seeing tshuvos. And what the Gaonim are doing is they now have this position of authority over Bavel, at least, and in general are respected in other parts of the world too, including emerging communities in Europe. and elsewhere, and North Africa, for example, and people are coming to them and they're asking them questions about how to conduct themselves Jewishly, how to keep halacha and stuff like that, and they're viewed as authorities. So they're writing these tshuvos all over the place, and that's sort of become sort of the first large collection we have of written material at the same time as the Gemara is starting now to be written down finally. So also we're getting these tshuvos, and indeed one very important tshuva is the Jews of Spain wrote to Rav Amram Gon, and they say, we know that we're supposed to be saying 100 brachos every day. So how do we do that? And they reference, I believe, also Rav Nachman Nigon had written an earlier tshuva on this issue too, but they wanted something more detailed. And so Rav Amram Gon says, here you go. I'm going to set down the whole liturgy for you. I'm going to set down the whole Seder, and you'll know then how to say 100 brachos a day. And not only did he include the whole Seder, but also we have other additional things for festivals, you know, the Machzor, and also the Haggadah. The Haggadah also gets included in that long tshuva, which then is now known today as Seder of Amram Gon.
So that's really fascinating. I think this is an extreme example. If I could say broadly, I would say there's like a kind of a dichotomy, a chakira, if you will, in Shalos Tshuvos. Sometimes the posig is literally just trying to give the shoel the specific answer that they need for a situation. Other times, they use the shaila as an opportunity, as a chitimsa, to provide a broader discourse that they intend to be there for future generations. And, you know, you'll see that in, I don't want to start giving examples, but I mean, like, you know, Rav Asher Weiss, it's very clear from many of his tshuvos, maybe a shul asked it, but now he's going to write an entire halakhic essay on it. And many poskim do this. And many poskim can actually shift between two different modalities as well. So this is an extreme example of where he's like, here's one shaila, and now I'm going to set forth the entire liturgy for the Jewish people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is really interesting. It's not, when I first learned that, I'm like, well, this is surprising. It's not the way I usually think of a tshuva to work.
Right.
But it's definitely very interesting. So one thing you'll find in this tshuva, and I am kind of getting to the specific tshuva about the Haggadah that we're going to spend our time on here, is that in Rav Amram Gon's Seder, he'll often have these other insertions. Like he'll insert other sort of disquisitions on unrelated topics, or like not just the liturgy itself, but he'll go through halachic analyses of particular portions of the Seder or something like that. And when he does the Haggadah, at the very beginning of the Haggadah, he inserts this tshuva, this earlier tshuva from his predecessor in Surah, Rav Nachman Nigon. Because they were both Gonim in Surah, I believe Rav Amram Gon was the direct successor to Rav Nachman Nigon. So he quotes his predecessor in this tshuva. And this is about what you are supposed to say in the Haggadah and what you are not supposed to say. So I guess I'll dive right into the content, or do you have a...
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we don't need to obviously read line for line, but, you know, let's get a general sense of what were the ambiguities at the time. Because again, you know, you pick up your Rabbi Soloveitchik, well, there's like 10 million Rabbi Soloveitchik Haggadah, it's not a good example. Or you pick up Rabbi Lam Haggadah, like the text pretty much is the same from one to the other. It's just the commentary that differs. So yeah, what does he actually lay out, and what about it is surprising?
Yeah, so right, as you say, that today you pick up the Haggadah and it's pretty much all the same, with maybe some, you know, maybe if you have a Nusach Sfard one, it's going to be slightly different than Nusach Ashkenaz and the way they organize the Hallel or something like that. But for the most part, it's going to be identical at this point. And indeed, it's been that way for a long time. But at least at the time of Nachman Nigon, you see that was not the case. And he notes several features of a Haggadah that it seems like he's seen, or at least has been asked about, that he feels are very problematic. And just to give you a sampling of what these ones are, and this is how he starts off the tshuva, he says, in Kiddush, we always say, Asher Baruch Rabbanu Mikol HaAmim, and all that, in the Yom Tov Kiddush, who chose us from all the nations. He sees this nosach of Asher Kiddush Es Yisrael, he sanctified Israel. Okay, now that's unusual. That's certainly something we don't have today. And then he notes also something even more, perhaps more bigger, a larger change. It says when you finish Manish Tana, and you say Avadi Ayinu, we have the words after that when we start telling the story. We have Mitchila of the Avodah Zara Hayu Avosenu, that we say first our ancestors were idol worshippers, and then, you know, they came, they, you know, they found that, you know, they came to Hashem and all that. And he says in this Haggadah he's seen, it just starts with Psukim from Sefer Yoshua, which we do say, but in our Haggadah we give that introduction of Mitchila, Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. And over here in this Haggadah, it just starts with the Psukim from Yoshua, V'yomer Yehoshua El Ha'am.
So it pulled out the exposition.
It pulled out the exposition. It just has the Pasuk only, right? And then he says in this other Haggadah he's seen, it has the Psukim of Arami Oved Avi, which are, you know, the central sort of point of our Haggadic Midrash, our exegesis, where we start like explicating line by line, sort of various midrashim on each line. And he says, Ein Omer Midrash Klal. It's Pesukim Kamo Shehein Ve'ein Omer Midrash Klal. And then you go right to Rabban Gamliel and his three things, Pesach, Matzah, Morar. So this is what he notes about this Haggadah. And he's not very happy about this.
Right. This isn't just someone, with my temperament who doesn't have a lot of patience for a lot of reading and downtime, but there seems to be a more fundamental issue with this Haggadah that he raises philosophically.
Yeah. And he says it's a tema gadol. And he says, if you keep this minhag, not only are you not yotze, he says, Misha osakein minhu. He's a heretic. The person is a heretic. V'chaluk leiv hu v'chover b'divrei chachamim. He's denying the words of chachamim. Voza divrei mishnah v'talmud. He's actually embarrassing or disgracing the words of the mishnah and the talmud. And he goes even further and he says you have to even excommunicate this person and separate them from the Jewish community. And at first you read that and you're like, whoa, that's really something. These seem like, you know, they're differences from our current Haggadah, but they don't seem so terrible. But he goes on and he explains why he's so upset about this. And he says he feels that it's against the Talmud Bavli because our Gemara has these phrases. It says, you know, according to one opinion that you're supposed to say Mitchila of Devar Hayu Avoseinu. And the understanding is also that, you know, and that you should be doing Midrash. And he feels that the fact that they're not doing the Midrash and they're not saying the words in the Gemara is a sign that this was actually written by the Karaites.
Ooh, so these aren't just a bunch of, lazy balabatim who wanted the express version of the Haggadah. These are people who are Karaim, Karaites, who fundamentally deny the rabbinic tradition. And so basically they've cut out the Medrash, they've cut out all the drushos that are introduced by the rabbinic tradition, and they're saying all we need are the psukim of Tanakh and Vizehu. That's it. And of course, this was the grand heresy of the day that rabbinic Judaism was fighting against. And so I can understand his very strong language where he says they're literally kofar b'divrei chachamim. They are kofar the words of the rabbinic tradition. So I could see why he's taking such a strong stance over here. And I think he even mentions some of them by name. I'm not familiar with so much Karaim, with so many Karaim. So I think he mentions a Daniel, was it perhaps? He throws an Elazar, Aluf from Aspamia, who apparently wrote his own Sefer HaMitzvos. Can you tell us just like a little bit about the kind of heresy that he was facing in his day?
Yeah. So yeah, I can talk about that briefly.
Sure.
Yeah. So I mean, how the Karaites started is again an academic debate, which we can't really get into the whole thing. But at least at the time, it was understood that there was a person named Anan who was the founder of the Karaites, and he's one of the people that Rav Natronai mentions in this tshuva. Now scholars think that the Ananites were probably a different group that later merged into the Karaites, sort of maybe around a little after the time of Rav Natronai, but Rav Natronai clearly understood that it's all sort of one group, at least in his view. And Anan wrote something called the Sefer HaMitzvos. Now, my understanding is that when he's saying this, Marna Varavna Lazar Aluf from Spain, from Inaspamia, from Spain, I think he's saying that this person showed him the Sefer HaMitzvos of Anan. I think that's what he's saying in the Tshuva.
So this shouldn't be confused with the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvos, I presume.
Right, this is a different Sefer HaMitzvos. And Anan wrote a Sefer HaMitzvos, and I think to the extent I understand it, he lays out his own method of exegesis, which in some ways is similar to the way our rabbis, our Chazal, you know, will look at Psukim and try to make comparisons between Psukim. So for example, he'll have a Gezeirah Shavah where you have like words that you compare, but they're different Gezeirot Shavas. I believe I read that some of them are even based on just one letter as opposed to a whole word, which is pretty surprising from our perspective. We don't have Gezeirot Shavas based on just a single letter.
That's even more extreme than Chazal would go.
Right. Exactly.
It's kind of ironic. But, you know, it's funny. I love it whenever someone names it Sefer called the Sefer HaMitzvos because, you know, to the onlooker, oh, it sounds so dispositive and authoritative. It's the Sefer HaMitzvos. It's a great branding strategy. But also what I notice is that he brands them as Venasu Umala Atzo, and they become their own nation. So it's interesting. It's not like, you know, I imagine nowadays we always have these debates about the lines and limits of orthodoxy. And so here you have the Geonim push. I don't know if the Karaites actively said we were a separate nation from, or they saw them as, you know, it's interesting because is it just that the Rabbanites were pushing out the Karaites, or did the Karaites actively wish to separate themselves? They also thought that the rabbinic Jews were heretics.
Right. So it's an interesting question. And again, I'm not familiar with all the specifics of the time, but I think, again, like they were probably more similar at the time and more together at the time than this tshuva might give the impression to. And I do think a lot of it was trying to make a clearer separation between the two groups because the Gaonim really thought the Karaites were heretics and were not following Chazal and the tradition properly. At the same time, over time, the Karaites did also come to see themselves more as a separate group. And this Daniel that they mentioned, I think the person they're referring to is this Daniel Akumasi, I think is his name. And he was an important Karaite who then actually founded a group in the land of Israel, which then became sort of the stronghold later, actually, of the Karaites throughout a lot of the medieval period and onward. And I think he's sort of, you know, making it a more distinct group. But indeed, the Gonim are fighting against them because, you know, they really do feel the need to make this separation.
Right. And so, okay, so this is like a really fascinating overview. We should definitely dedicate a future episode just to talking about Karaim. But I know that, Yossi, if you really wanted to talk about the liturgical development in general and using kind of the Haggadah as this case study. So maybe break it down for us. So we see this kind of formalism that comes from Siddur Dura Avamram Gaon. And yet we still see that throughout the years, Ashkenazim, Sfardim, there's been so many variations in the standardized prayer. Does that mean that the Siddur Dura Avamram's attempt to formalize prayer for all of Jewry, I don't want to say failed, but it wasn't a complete success?
Yeah, so that's a very important question. And let me actually take a step back before I answer that, because I think we have to sort of close the chapter on this particular tshuva, because it really unlocks, I think, this question in an important way. And that is that it turns out that for many years, we did not have this Haggadah text that Rav Natronai was polemicizing against. But then when the Cairo Geniza was discovered or popularized by Solomon Schechter in the late 19th century, we started to get a lot more manuscripts in the Geniza, you know, buried there, you know. The material was kept there for generations and in pretty good condition. And among the things we found were manuscripts of Haggadot. And among those Haggadot, we indeed found many that were actually very, very similar to the one Rav Natronai was talking about. And they are not Karaite Haggadahs. And we know they're not Karaite Haggadahs. And it's kind of even clear from Rav Natronai's tshuva itself, because he says that they actually say the psukim, not psukim, sorry, they say the Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer and Pesach Matzah Maror. And that's the rabbinic tradition. The Karaites wouldn't have recognized that. The Karaites' Haggadah, from what I understand, is just psukim only. It doesn't have any rabbinic statements in there.
Wow, so boring.
Yeah. But in any event, so it would seem, though, that these Haggadah fragments that we found in the Cairo Geniza are representative of the Eretz Yisrael Nusach. And this is where we kind of get to this major divide in liturgy. In Eretz Yisrael, they generally had a very different liturgy than they had in Bavel. And the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah, it was indeed much shorter. In this Haggadah we found the Geniza, we have this phrase, Asher Kiddash Es Yisrael, in the Kiddush. We have the fact that the words Mechila of the Avodah Zarah are not present. We have either no Midrash sometimes on Arami Oved Avi in some of the versions, or if we have Midrash on Arami Ovid Avi, it's much shorter. And it's not as fully developed as the one we have in our Haggadahs today. And it's really, Yes, and really this was the tradition in Eretz Yisrael. And the reason this tradition died out is really because of the supremacy of the Talmud Bavli and of Siddur of Amram Gaon.
But you didn't need to be a heretic necessarily to have this text. And really, the fact that Rav Amram Gaon had to spell out what our liturgical text would be presupposes that there was a lack of clarity until that point. It's like, you know, whenever you learn a Tosos and it says Vim Tomar, you know, you might think to say X, Y, and Z. Many times you can rest assured there's another Rishon somewhere who suggested that very idea, and therefore Tosos needs to preempt it. So the fact that Amram Gaon had to actually lay this all out meant that there may have been a very reasonable alternative tradition, like you're pointing out.
Right. Yes. And that's indeed the case here. And it's true of the Haggadah. And it's true of the Siddur. The Eretz Yisrael tradition, as might be expected, is much more prevalent in the Talmud. You see it in the Talmud Yerushalmi. So for example, with the Haggadah in particular, like it seems from the Yerushalmi, and I don't want to get too into the weeds about the text here, but it seems from the Yerushalmi that the Yerushalmi would say, at least you don't actually say the words, Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah, Hayu Avosenu. That according to the Yerushalmi, the position is that Mitchila, meaning first, you start with the psukim from Sefer Yehoshua that talk about how Terach, the father of Abraham, was an idol worshiper, but you don't actually say the words "Mechila Avdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu." And indeed, it's really only in the Bavli where the opinions of Rav and Shmuel diverge. Where Rav says you say the words "Mechila Avdei Avodah Zarah," and Shmuel says you say "Avedim Hayinu." And nowadays, we do both in our Haggadah. But if from the Yerushalmi alone, you wouldn't see the necessity of saying those words. So, and that is indeed the Eretz Yisrael tradition. And this is sort of a, you know, a debate that runs through, it's not a debate, but like a disparity that runs through the whole liturgy between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, not just with the Haggadah, that Eretz Yisrael is relying on different traditions than Bavel. And they have different formulations, for example, in some of the brachos, in Shmona Esrei, but mostly small differences, different formulations in other parts of Tefillah as well. And what the Gaonim were doing is when, for example, Amram Gaon, when he wrote a Siddur, was standardizing the liturgy and saying, this is what we do. And to a certain extent, the traditions of the land of Israel were erased through this process.
Wow.
And that many communities, it did not spread the same way that the traditions of Bavel spread.
Well, this is kind of, I think, how you see halachic development work in general, is that, you know, you could look back, I mean, classically at the Gemara, and you'll see debate in the Gemara, but eventually, for whatever reason, we adopt a certain shita in the Gemara, and that's what you see appears in the different codes of law, that's what you see in the Torah, and filters in Shulchan Aruch, etc., etc. So it's not surprising to me that eventually push came to shove. Though I think what is interesting, and I would love if you could connect the dots for us, is that what many of our listeners, including myself, are probably more intimately familiar with is the disparity between, broadly speaking, Ashkenazic liturgy and Sephardic liturgy. And even within what we call, quote, Ashkenazic and Sephardic, there's a huge breakdown as well. So how do we get from the Bavli-Yerushalmi disparity to the Ashkenazic-Sephardic disparity, and do they line up?
Yeah, so sure. I mean, so some of the differences already date back sort of pre-Gaonim, because you have to think about this, that even before the Gaonim came on the scene, different communities, let's say you're in Spain, let's say you're in France, whatever it is, you're going to have somewhat different traditions about how you're going to daven. The Jewish world was not as connected then as it is today, obviously. But it's really a Siddur of Amram Gaon that kind of spread throughout Spain and Northern Europe, all these different places. And that kind of became an established liturgy. There's also Siddur of Sadia Gaon a little bit later, which is similar, but has some differences. But it's really Siddur of Amram Gaon that's adopted. The differences now that we see between Ashkenaz and Sephardi davening, really, some of them, you know, as I said, were probably pre-existing, but some of them also came later. In some cases, for example, a Siddur of Amram Gaon is more close to the Sephardic liturgy, and the Ashkenazic one was sort of developed of traditions on its own in those areas. It's hard to sort of say there's a very clear, moment where these things divided. I will say the Siddur of Amram Gaon serves as the basis for both traditions. Some of the things we also see in the Sephardic liturgy today are later. They're sort of post The spread of Kabbalah, the Arizal and Sfat adding things or changing the, you know, there's sort of the idea of like doing these Yehudim or these ways to like combine letters and combine the divine name in Tefillah. That's kind of Kabbalistic. But it,
I
yeah,
always
it's a
imagine
long
this
history.
magical aura surrounding them as they chant these incantations.
Yeah.
Though I think Yemenites might be unique in fact that they side with the Rambam purely.
Right.
What I'm interested also is you mentioned these additions. So the Sfarim took on a lot of mystical elements, and then Hasidim later kind of came up with Nusach Sfard. And there's I think a tshuva of Rav Moshe where he's not such a fan. How can you go ahead and I don't know if he's not the word adulterate, but he basically, how can you alter our Ashkenazic tradition that we have? But I think one of the hallmarks when we think about Ashkenazic liturgy and its development is one of my favorite go-to topics, the introduction of Piyutim. And how we have it, I would say ad nauseum. Some people can't get enough of it. So, how does the introduction of Piyutim become very prevalent within Ashkenazic liturgy and even in Sephardic liturgy? Correct me if I'm wrong. They seem to have added some stuff along the way as well.
Yeah, so that's also a very interesting question. So
I know a bit of a
Piyutim,
Pandora's box.
yeah. Well, I'll try to give like a 2-minute overview standing on one foot, but Piyutim are generally most of the early Piyutim developed in the land of Israel. Sort of the same tradition where this early Haggadah came about is where the Piyutim came to be. You have people like Rav Elazar HaKalir writing these very complex Piyutim based on Midrash, based on new words that he's kind of coined, and these very kind of complex things. They changed from week to week also. Like these really big virtuosic kind of Paitanim would write for a special Shabbatot or other times they'd write new piyutim or even from week to week there'd be new things and sometimes I think scholars think these even replaced parts of the sort of the main sort of ikar of davening that we think of today what they call like the statutory liturgy and academic speak and this is another thing the Gaonim of Bavel were not happy about.
Right. And that's so funny because you basically nowadays it's so funny because many traditionalists will argue. I mean, I think the Rama himself also codifies the idea that, you have to say the Yotzros, you have to do all these piyutim. And what's funny is, I think based on what you're saying, is that they were originally developed ad hoc for occasions to spice up the davening, and now they've become a formalized fixture, which just drags on the davening for many people, or I might be projecting, but that's at least how I feel many times.
Right. So it's one of these things where kind of over time you sort of in the beginning you sort of have this big debate between sort of the fixed liturgy and the piyutim, but over time the two sides do come together to a certain degree. And this already starts happening Gaonic Bavel. So the Gaonim are polemicizing against the piyutim and saying they certainly shouldn't replace the main tefillah. There's a letter that's well known from this scholar, rabbinic scholar named Pircori ben Bavoy, who wrote that, how can you change from the matbea of tefillah of the chachamim, the way they established the brachos of Shemoneh Esrei? You're certainly not in the first three brachos of Shemoneh Esrei when you're praising Hashem and you're opening sort of to your tefillah. How can you then start suddenly inserting all these piyutim that don't belong there? But later on, it kind of we reach some kind of synthesis or compromise, or maybe we don't put piyutim anymore in the first three brachos, or if we do, we make sure we say all the regular words also. We maybe have piyutim at certain fixed places. Some of the piyutim get shortened, some of them get eliminated. In Sephardic countries, they also have piyutim, as you mentioned, but they tend to be much more grammatical. They tend to be much more sort of classical Hebrew poetry, I guess I would say, as opposed to sort of the very complex Midrashic poetry or of Elazar HaKalir and others that continues more in Ashkenaz only, but you do see piyutim widely adopted throughout the Jewish community throughout the Jewish world, just in maybe a slightly different format than it was originally. And again, it's a huge
Hey,
topic.
as long as I get to sing Adon HaSlichot with the Sfardim, I'm happy. I don't know what the
That's a
rest of the stuff
beautiful
they
one.
do is, but we have a Sfardic minion at our shul, and I kept telling him the issue was that their Slichot sometimes They'd have to do it in the morning. That's when they would get people. Not early, early morning, like morning, morning. And so I wanted to hear Adonai Slichot. They kept inviting me in, but then I had to be down for Ashkenazi Slichot. One time I had to go up there to make an announcement. I came in as they're doing Adonai. I was like, oh, Baruch Hashem, I got the experience. Though I should say I have a very unpopular opinion. I do actually enjoy might be the wrong word, but I get a lot of gratification out of the Ashkenazi Slichos. Like, I love, like, Vayavor Hashem Alpana Vayikra. You know, like, I actually like the whole experience. I think it's great. Anyway, I'm really enjoying picking your brain because you have a lot to share. I know that you actually had certain things that you wanted to share with us, and I realize that I've been enjoying myself so much, I hope you as well, that we are getting close to the end of our session together. So Yosef, is there anything else just about the development of the Haggadah, about the Gaona in particular, that you want our listeners to know?
But I think we actually did a pretty good job of covering a lot of it already, which is great. And I mean, I mean, I think if I want to leave your listeners with something on this topic, it's that the Haggadah we have today is indeed quite fixed, and it has been from the time of Avraham Gaon, and certainly, you know, the advantage of a fixed text is, you know, it's something we can return to every year, and something that, you know, is comfortable, and something, you know, that is very important part of our tradition. But it's also important to recognize that these things don't arise in a vacuum. It's not the Mishnah. While the Mishnah lays out sort of how you do a Seder in broad strokes, the details of all the, and some of the words of the Haggadah are indeed in the Mishnah. Not everything is. And we have to recognize that the Haggadah and the Siddur are texts that develop over time. They're texts that sort of add pieces here and there. And it's good to think about sort of the way our tefillah grows, and the way our tefillah changes over time, because I think it gives us an appreciation of how we're part of a chain that, you know, is not always static, but is changing and growing. And I think it's in a non-problematic way. I mean, I don't think anyone would say that we have to believe that the Haggadah was handed down on Har Sinai.
Yeah. I was just thinking that.
Yeah. But it is good to see also that it develops a consensus over time. And the Gaonim were certainly a very important part of setting not only the text of the Haggadah, but the text of the Siddur. And it really serves as the basis for really all this tefillot that we say today.
Right. It forms like a very important just structural baseline that we all have, that we have a set text in that respect. I think it's also important just to appreciate and understand, like you're pointing out for us, that there are certain things that we actually have biblical origin, many that come from Mishnayos and from Gemaras, and then some that were later. And I think it's really important, certainly when you're in a Shas and Chak, like when we had COVID, and we had to figure out what were the essential prayers that we had to say, and knowing what was mandated by the Gemara and knowing what was a later medieval Ashkenazi introduction helped us understand what to prioritize. And, you know, this is where I give my stump speech about Tircha d'Tzibura and asking if something is like a very later introduction and it's dragging people's Kavana out, what do we do about that? Baruch Hashem, there's an essay in the Lehrhaus that you helped edit about that. I think one or two of them. So we'll let our listeners Google for that. But Yosef, you want to just briefly tell us right before we complete our session together, any other interesting projects that you're in the middle of, or anything our listeners should look forward to?
Sure. Yeah. So I actually just completed a series that listeners to this particular episode might find interesting at Torah and Moshe. I was giving some lectures on the history of the Siddur, although not the Siddur as in the development of the liturgy we just talked about, but sort of the 20th century Hebrew English Siddur and some of the different versions that are out there and sort of what they say about the development of Orthodoxy. So in America, so you can check that out at Torah in Motion. That's all on YouTube. One of the things I like to write about in general and speak about are sort of the history of translation, the history of commentary on the Siddur and Chumash, because I always find it fascinating how obviously the Chumash and the Siddur are timeless texts, and the Chumash in particular, you know, is handed down from Har Sinai to us from Hashem. But at the same time, the way we interpret it and the way we try to make it relevant for each generation does change. So it's interesting to think about the way that shifts over time.
100%. And I appreciate your modesty. You didn't even talk about all your science fiction writing. So maybe we'll have to dedicate a future episode to talking about that. But anyway, Yosef, it's a real pleasure to be able to talk as close to face-to-face as possible without the in-person. God willing, should see you in person sometime soon. And wishing you much hatzlacha with all of your many endeavors, all of your many different publications. And to our listeners, make sure to put into your Google search engine, Yosef Lindell. And I am confident there'll be many wonderful things that will come up. Thank you, Yosef, so much for your time and expertise. And wishing you and your family a Freilich and Purim. We're recording this before Purim. And also, of course, a Chag Kasher V'Sameach as Pesach is soon approaching.
Thank you, Moshe. It was a joy to be on your podcast. And I wish you much haslacha, reaching listeners and spreading Torah through this venue. It's been great. And again, yeah, Freilich and Purim, Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.